Good morning, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. I highly appreciate it. It means a lot to me that you've taken your time to expose yourself to my thoughts and my ideas. I'm interested in your ideas as well, and as I've been trying to promote on the show for quite a while, my email address is very available. You can contact me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com very easily, and we can have a discussion, and I could get your thoughts and your ideas onto this medium. That's one of my goals. Another one of my goals is to push my idea of unconditional love. You know, I know a long time ago on the show we talked about the difference between empathy and sympathy, but I'd also like to bring in this word compassion. Does empathy require compassion? I'm not quite sure. I see compassion and this ability to give sympathy to anybody, you know, and that's part of this unconditioned response. You can give love to somebody without knowing where they are in their life, in their head, or in their struggles. You know, you can give somebody love without knowing anything about them. So you don't have to empathize with them to be able to give them compassion. Yet, I do believe that every single one of us is born in love and with love. I feel that at our heart, at our core, at the center of ourself is a bead of love. At this point, the real question becomes, once we have recognized this bottomless source of love inside of us, what do we do with it? There's a lot of ways we could manage our love in small systems. You know, a lot of us form relationships, and we have friends, and we have family. Yet, I also think that there is a mass of life and beings out there that do not necessarily have any connections to our microsystems. So it's more of an attitude, really, than anything, is the ability to just be love and to have compassion for anything that comes towards you. That's kind of how I see this unconditioned response. In a way, I'm still working on it, and I still have some thoughts to iron out. But I also want to push curiosity, where this inspired reason to want to continue looking for what amazes us. In Kabbalah, which is Jewish mysticism, where mysticism is these smaller sects of mainstream religion. There are Christian mystics, and there are Jewish mystics, and Sikh mystics, and Islamic and Hindu mystics, and probably Gnostic mystics, and I would even dare say some sort of atheist mystic. But within Jewish mysticism, there's this idea called awe, and it's that feeling. Sometimes when you look at the sky and you see the clouds in a certain way and it lifts you, or for me, when I look out at the Colorado mountains, or I see weather, or I see something amazing done by my son, there's this moment of feeling of awe, of being awestruck, of seeing and being with the awesome. Awe is the primary piece that starts the curious movement. Because once we are in awe, the human intellect wants to figure it out. And so that's when we start to investigate. But I would say that awe exists outside of the intellect and is an independent resource that we are all capable of. Yet what I'm curious in and what I find intriguing and what I find to be of importance to me may not have anything to do with you. You may listen to this entire show and none of my ruminations might have any impact on you. But I hope that you feel my desire to want to know more and to want to be more in awe. And I hope that that feeling can virally pass to you. And I think that by you being a curious individual and by going out and being interested in what you're interested in, you can pass that virus to the people in your systems as well. I think it spreads. I think love spreads too. I think these sort of movements that we are seeing that have been developing for decades and centuries are culminating into a society that is becoming more aware. And that might just be my optimism, but I have a tremendous faith in where we're going and what we're doing. Yet, I don't know. That's my intro, guys. That's what I'm doing here. That's what we're doing here. So I very much appreciate you being here with me. Next, I'd like to discuss the relationship with doing things through the discussion of addiction and using of harmful substances. I had a good friend over last night and we had a tense conversation, not quite an argument, but definitely a placement of two valid disagreements where we both had two very different stances in what we were discussing. And it all started with discussing my use of psychedelics. And I've often heard of this, like, some people are worried that they're going to mess up their serotonin or that they think that they have a lower serotonin than others. And I'm not quite sure that's how serotonin works or what it does. And I'm very murky over what mental health science, social sciences as a whole, how mature they are as an empirical source. You know, I do think that there is good science and that scientists are doing a noble act. But when it comes to the inner world of our consciousness, I'm not sure how much science has been able to chunk into good definitions. Because I don't think that consciousness is strictly a material and chemical thing. Also, I am uneasy when I see most of these tests that a lot of the science will pull its deductions and its theories from when it comes to mental health and the use of substances are usually a very small pockets of people. If you have 200 people, even if they're half male and half female, how can you randomly pick enough from a society of 365 million to extrapolate that your population of 200 is adequate enough to make any statement about consciousness as a whole? When the myriad of experience itself, subjective experience from the standpoint of each individual and each independent witnessing observer is so diverse, there's a myriad of experience out there. Every single being has a different vantage point. Yet, as humans, we are all using similar material, collective sensory information. So, of course, we're going to get very similar chunks when we look around at the world around us. I can look forward, since I'm sitting in my closet right now, and I could see all of my t-shirts, and I can assume that I have two arms, and that most t-shirts are made in a very similar way, and most people probably feel very similarly about t-shirts. You know, we feel the texture the same. If they stink, if we don't wash them, we smell them the same. Depending on the color and the texture, we can assume that we see similar ideas of texture, even if my idea of blue may be very different than your idea of blue. But there's enough valid interpenetrations of various viewpoints that we can validate what we may decide to call our group experience. And all of a sudden, if you have a group experience, those who stand outside of it or who have drastically different viewpoints, those people are labeled as insane, or in the new mental health world, sick. I'm always concerned about labeling the mentally unstable as sick and medicalizing this moment, because when someone is sick, there are certain things that we do to treat them. I'm very nervous consistently about trying to treat mental health in the classical medical sense, where you give somebody pills. There's these chemical material components that are meant to fit and fix the physical material vessel that we sit inside, our bodies, you know. And in that world, it makes sense. It makes sense to try to fix the material. But consciousness, for me, isn't entirely material, and so I'm not convinced that there's a pill out there that could fix anybody. You can bend consciousness in a lot of different ways. There's stimulants, and there's depressants, and there's hallucinogens, and there's all kinds of weird side chemicals like ketamine and caffeine that do in-between things, and you can research all their effects later. I'm not going to go into it. But all these are different verifications that of consciousness bent. And some people become very fond of a archetype of themselves. If you're struggling and you're in pain and you can take a chemical that gives that chemical good feeling, that high, of course somebody can seek that over and over and over and over and over again. And whilst doing that, the user who's seeking this chemical high may over time stop taking care of themselves, stop taking care of their teeth. They may stop cleaning themselves. They may stop eating well. Or they may be so poor that the food sources that they don't get aren't of fresh value and don't have the natural and necessary nutrients that is needed to have a physical vessel at peak experience. And when our bodies aren't well, we can't collect sensory information well. And what is the consciousness supposed to do but mire in that? You see? But the approach towards seeking to be away from themselves, because that's the initial point, right? There's pain and there's suffering prior to seeking an activity to relieve it. I would even hazard to argue that the baseline is sorrow and suffering, and that out of sorrow and suffering, we are able to transmute that into joy and into our rationalized experience, and then further into our emotional experience, the intuitive world. But does the drug cause that decay? Or is it the person's relationship with the physical substance and their world? What about the stigma that is around any sort of use of anything? Stigma's a bitch, man. There is this mythology around the walking dead with the walking mentally dead, you know, the vagabond and the degenerates of society, the sick, yet again. So we are told, and especially for me, like I have this perfect example because I had my mother. My mother was not part of my life. My father raised me, and I met my mother when I was 16. And I was always told from a very young age that the reason that I didn't have a mom is because she was a drug addict and because she had chosen that life over me. So when I grew up, I had this long run of investigating to figure out why she would do that, which is a big part of my lackadaisical free use of things throughout the last couple decades. Yet, being told that at a young age, that here is this person who has been broken by something to the point that they don't want to be your mother anymore, it's this powerful story of what we begin to believe is intrinsically bound in the use, but may not be. And I'm not trying to make an argument for people going and using toxic substances. And I'm not trying also to make any sort of extrapolation where I judge one substance worse or better than another. I'm purely analyzing right now the why and the background noise that makes people want to use. And how we may use activity as well as chemical substances. People can be reckless and angry too, rather than, you know, injecting themselves with heroin. But there have been many other societies and other ways of approaching use. Alcohol has been freely used in human society for millennia, and I would hazard to say that there was very few alcoholics in the medieval ages, but I'm sure there was a lot of people who were killing themselves with alcohol, sure. But was the society looking at these people as alcoholics the way that we do now? When somebody does not control their drinking, when they become belligerent, there's a judgment with it in our society. You know, there's a conversation about rehabilitation and not drinking in our society. And I'm not sure that there was any of those sort of things back then, that is. Fast forward to the 1800s, and you have heroin and cocaine and all kinds of other things that are incredibly regulated in our modern era that were freely available over the counter. And use of morphine and pills and all kinds of things was so normal, even in academic society. You know, Shakespeare was found with dozens of opium pipes in his front yard. All sorts of prominent figures that I don't want to say any direct names right now because I can't think of specifics. But I'm sure if you start to gander, you'll find that a lot of scientists and a lot of artists throughout history have also been casual drug users. Were they sick? Or did they live in a different society where it was more available and less judged? I wonder how damaging the toxicity of the myth and the stigma of the sick man or woman has on a person's self-fulfilling prophecy, where we label ourselves as an addict and then we continue to perpetuate the story that we are told. Let's take marijuana, for instance, which I pretty much casually smoke for every one of these episodes, and I find it as a good lubricant for my ideas. Yet, I've been smoking for, let's see here, I started when I was 13, so 15 years ago. I've been smoking for 15 years. So, if you look up the classical spreadsheet of what an addiction is, you know, square one, you should continue to use more and more and more over time. Sure, there have been periods in my life where I've smoked a gratuitous amount of marijuana, but I honestly don't smoke that much. As I have a very low amount compared to other points in my life. So instead of having a graph where I steadily use more and more and more throughout my life, I've had these ups and downs, this like up, down, up, down, up, down. But over the last 5-6 years in my maturity as an adult, I've found the best way to use it in the lowest range, and I very rarely smoke more or less than I usually do. And yes, I'm very dependent, and if I don't smoke, I'll probably be a raging asshole. So I need it in the classical sense. Yet you don't see me on this runaway train, which is, I think, part of that mythology that people start to perpetuate. Second, you should have diminishing results over time, right? It's not like I don't feel it at all anymore. My head has grown, and so using marijuana when I was younger and using it now are two definitely different experiences, and I would expect 10 years from now my being then will experience it differently than my being now, and I might use it for different reasons. Yet, it's not like I've had diminishing results continuously over time. When I approach marijuana, I get exactly what I want out of it every time, you know. Yet, classical addiction would say that that shouldn't be the case. And lastly, physical use continues despite negative reactions. And sure, memory is an issue with marijuana smoking. My short-term memory is not as sharp as it should be, which is why I'm very careful when I use direct quotations without having the material in front of me. And often I warn my audience that a lot of my dates and a lot of the specifics might be rough generalizations. Yet I have a stockpile of memory and a huge warehouse. That would be scary. Can you imagine a werewhore? I don't know. Anyways, but I have like a lot of information stored in long-term storage that I do have access to, that I've learned how to work within my consciousness to get at. And I feel like I'm remarkably functional despite all of the well-trodden, proven negative side effects of one of my favorite drugs. So, do I feel like a classic addict, even though I know I'm dependent? No. Do other people have a much worse relationship with marijuana and they don't have the same self-control that I think that I do? Certainly. Is there a range and a spectrum of relationships when it comes to the use of marijuana? Certainly. Even within the one specific individual and not just a spectrum among people. Because, of course, everybody has a different biology, so two different people are going to use differently. But even within one person over a timeline, say 10 years, that person is going to have a spectrum of ways that they approach different activities and things and ways that they can be. So nobody's a stagnant person, and that's part of why I don't see myself as inherently sick. It's worth the conversation to say yet again that I'm not trying to support casual toxic use, and I'm not saying that there aren't people out there who are hurting mentally, emotionally, and physically because of substances. I have had very bad relationships with things in my past and been hurt and had regrets about how I abused this vessel and my consciousness with toxic substances. But I also think that people have an immense potency within them and potential and a capability. And I know it sounds fucking cheesy as hell, but to make lemonade out of lemons is one of the biggest transmutations of the suffering of a long-term quote-unquote addiction. And I'm not trying to be sarcastic, you know. I have hurt myself before. And I know that somebody out there who may listen to this might be in the depths of a bad relationship with a substance. But just like you can get out of a bad relationship with a person, you can change how you do things. You can change how you feel about things. And a lot of that starts with compassion for ourselves. That starts with wanting better for ourselves. It starts with a real good look at what we're doing and how we feel about what we're doing. If we're in a bad relationship, we are in the utmost control to change it and to do something differently. But that starts with being aware and looking at it right in the face. And sometimes that's hard to accept that we don't like what we're doing. But I hazard all to not consider themselves as lost or sick. This might not be a medicalized problem. Do we medicalize and treat somebody and give somebody medication or treat them like a subpar individual because they've been in a bad relationship with a person? you know? Do we take away somebody's decision-making and their ability to judge a situation because they chose a bad relationship with a person? So why not take away that agency of a person who has a bad relationship with themselves and the activities that they're doing? I think it is systemically from the environment first and not from the object of suffering. And that could also apply to a lot of various other activities, which I think earlier I mentioned recklessness and anger. These are also self-mutilating activities that also hurts the group collective as well, which intrinsically makes another self-fulfilling prophecy where we degenerate again emotionally. Gambling, poor money skills. Like, I've been having issues with buying food lately, and I'll go to the grocery store and have very good intentions and yet still walk out with $250, and 60% of it is stuff that I don't need, and I'm just spending money in a very haphazard way. And that might be part of the recklessness issue as well. But yeah. Anyways, I'm going to stop talking about this now. I hope that that's not insulting to anybody out there. I felt a lot of tenseness with my partner in conversation last night when I was trying to describe some of these ideas. So I have a feeling that some people will hear this and might feel insulted. And so I really intend to rectify that, and I can try to describe it in a different way because I really don't want to think of it that way. And I do think that people out there, there's a lot of people who do need help. They need emotional and societal support, but I don't think they need to be medicalized. But if you do have a various opinion, please, I'll put it on the show. And if you think I said anything wrong, I'll call myself out. So please reach out to me, especially if you feel any tension from any of the points made this morning. Well, I think it's time to step into a good book and read a little bit of quotation from a prominent figure I find of influence. I'm going to go grab that. Firstly, since I mentioned it earlier, I'm going to be reading from Pearl Epstein's Kabbalah, The Way of the Jewish Mystic, which is a collection of, it's like a rough synopsis of what Kabbalism is. This shit's really murky and I still don't have a great grasp on it. But this segment kind of mentions awe and it kind of mentions union with reality. So this is from chapter 2, Love, the Journey to God. With his soul sufficiently cleansed by the ethical and spiritual practices centered on awe, the mystic, now filled with a lover's yearning for a glimpse of the beloved, is prepared to reflect a vision of the absolute. Though it is not yet classified as union, this stage, depicted in the erotic imagery of Solomon's Song of Songs, is a very elevated one. The mystic no longer feels himself to be a minute, insignificant creature separated by eons in space and time from his creator, but now regards God as his own dodi, which means dear friend. Even at this exalted level, the lover approaches his goal in stages. The interdependence of the entire chain of worlds along the cosmic tree allows him to work with love as he has had with awe, in the knowledge that God, his idea, and his word are one. Therefore, in the corresponding microcosm of his own mind, the mystic's thought, speech, and action may also be united as one. Emptied of his ego, he too is free to create new worlds with each breath and to destroy them with each expiration. So, what you're seeing here is the personification of the individual relationship with another act of doing. In this case, a relationship with the idea of God, which some may not be able to hold as close as others. I myself was a firm atheist and then agnostic for a large portion of my life, and I couldn't even entertain the idea of God without having sort of this flinch internally because of other things that have been attached to it. But this is having a relationship with the world in a way. And I like how she, Mrs. Pearl, pointed out this idea of Dodi, of God or the world or this natural objectivity is one of our dearest friends. And when we see an old friend we haven't seen for a while, there's this tremendous happiness with it. And we can have that same approach and relationship towards life, you know, if that makes any sense. All right. Last but not least, let's do a chapter from The Tao Te Ching by the admirable and wise Lao Tzu. This is chapter 49 from a translation by Ralph Allen Dale. It's full of beautiful photos. I really quite enjoy it. Wise people are not absorbed in their own needs. They take the needs of all people as their own. They are good to be good, but they are also good to those who are still absorbed in their own needs. Why? Because goodness is in the very nature of the great integrity. Wise people trust those who trust, but they also trust those who do not trust. Why? Because trusting is in the very nature of the great integrity. Wise people merge with all others rather than stand apart judgmentally. In this way, all begin to open their ears and hearts, more prepared to return to the innocence of childhood. The great affirmation, growing backwards. As we mature, I think we find ourselves regressing into childhood once again, especially towards the end. All right, guys. Thank you so much for your attention and your ears. I cannot tell you enough how much I appreciate the fact that you are willing to give me your time. Thank you. You are an amazing being. I feel that you are divine inside. The fact that you woke up this morning and that you breathe makes me tremendously grateful. Have love. Be love. You are love. I'm going to go grab Odin. We'll see what he has to say for this week.
Hello, people. This is me, Asko.
Woo!
So, how was your day? How was your yesterday weekend?
How was your yesterday weekend?
Great.
What'd you do?
Nothing.
Did you have a snow day yesterday?
No.
How do you feel about snow days?
Boring.
You were bored? Would you have rather been at school?
Yes.
That's amazing. That kind of stuff makes me very happy. You know that? The fact that you like school so much. That's amazing.
Because you don't let me go outside.
Well, it's just really cold right now. But we got better snow sometime. You gotta trust me, that snow out there is very dry. It might be better today when the sun starts hitting it. When the sun hits the snow, it melts a little bit, and that makes it wetter. And a good snowball has to be wet snow. Right, people?
Yep.
But I love you, buddy. You know that?
Mm-hmm.
You know how important you are to me?
So much.
It's true. Don't touch. I love you.
Do you know how much? I'm going to do a science experiment. Okay. So, do you know octopuses, to survive, they actually eat their tentacles?
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. You just taught me something new.
What, really?
Mm-hmm. All right, guys. Thank you all. You have a wonderful week. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.